Hi everyone. Before we get started, I just wanted to let you know that today's episode will be the last one I release for a few weeks. I'm currently having a bit of a recording break, mainly because my kids are at home for the summer. However, I'll be getting back behind the microphone fairly soon, and I'm aiming to bring you new installments of the Movie Palace no later than the first week of October. If you can, keep an eye on our social media accounts for any further updates. Okay, let's get on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again for this week's episode, which is a book review episode. I'm going to be discussing three books that have recently been released. They're all from TCM and Running Press. I'll tell you what the books are in a moment, but first let me introduce today's guest. Appearing for the second episode in a row is Raquel Stetcher. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me back to talk about my favorite thing ever, which is film books.
Film books is such a great subject, and it's always a pleasure to talk books with you. How's it going? How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. And I'm really looking forward to discussing these titles, which are... So let's see. This is what we're going to talk about. So it's Hollywood Black by Donald Bogle, Dynamic Dames by Sloane DeForest, and Forbidden Hollywood by Mark A. Vieira. I mean, we'll talk about it, of course, Raquel, but it's a nice little range of books here, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we've actually been quite lucky this year to have these three books come out in such a short period of time. These are all three gems, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel positively about all of them, too. And it's interesting because I think like there's some overlap between them in some ways. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some films or some stars who are referred to in more than one of the titles. And the good thing is that this is quite timely as well because... I think it fits in quite nicely with your summer reading challenge, which you run every year, don't you? So just tell us a bit about that. How's it going so far this year?
So I run this challenge every single year where I encourage people who are like us, love classic films, collect film books, but maybe those film books kind of collect dust on the shelves. This is an opportunity for people to get those books out off the shelves and start reading them over the summer. So I challenge people to read up to six books. Some people have already read four or five, and the challenge isn't over until the middle of next month. And I have about, I think, a little over of maybe 30 participants, and I've already posted a list of reviews that have already come out. So this is just a really fun challenge. And what I like about it versus maybe just a standard book club is that you can read what you want. As long as it's in the classic film realm, you can pick novels, biographies, coffee table books, whatever you want. So it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And so is this the first podcast episode that's being kind of submitted as an entry? Is that right?
I think so, actually. That's pretty exciting.
It is. Well, let's get into the books then. So let's not be around the bush. Let's see what we made of them. And we're going to start with Donald Bogle's Hollywood Black, which it kind of chronicles the history of black performers and black filmmakers in American film from, I guess, the earlier days of the medium right up to the new millennium, right up to stuff like, you know, Black Panther and so on. And before we get into the book, Raquel, I'll tell you what I thought immediately upon reading it was it's kind of poignant, isn't it, that the foreword to the book is provided by the late John Singleton, you know, the filmmaker... He made films like Boys in the Hood, who died, you know, in an untimely manner not so long ago. So I thought that was kind of a sad, poignant note that it started on.
I agree. When I read it, it kind of broke my heart. But it's such, and it's also, it's a very short foreword, but it's very powerful and quite moving and hopeful. And when I read it, it's kind of melancholy reading it, knowing that, he recently passed away. It's also something that, it's like a little bit of his legacy in this book, so that's nice.
Yeah, because he obviously features later on, of course.
Right.
So, yeah, what did you think of this book overall? So how successful was Bogle here with what he was trying to do?
I really enjoyed this book. I think this was as best as you can get for a complete picture of African-American film history, which is, I have to say, that's a lot for a book that's, just under 300 pages. So he covers a lot of territory. And Donald Bogle is like preeminent historian on Black film history. So we're in good hands with him. He knows his stuff. And what I like about this book in particular is a lot of the observations that he has on things that are going on during different times of film history, and also observations on the actors and the actresses and the directors too, and their impact, either their performances or what they contributed to film history that made an impact. And yep. I love books with context, which this has plenty of, but it also mm-hmm. has just really amazing, insightful observations that made me stop and think and take some notes down, and made some notes to even just go back and watch some movies again, knowing these little tidbits. So to me, this was a very powerful book and very informative.
Yeah, I think so too. I really enjoyed it as well. As you say, it's from, you know, Donald Bogle, who's a preeminent writer in this field. And it's a bit of a contrast to his other stuff, I think. So he wrote a book that I read a little while ago, it's got a long title. So it's Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies and Books, An Interpretive History of Blacks in American Films. And I guess the thing with some of his earlier works is they're a bit of a more, they take a bit more of a scholarly approach, don't mm-hmm. they? Whereas this book covers a lot of the same ground as that book I just mentioned, but in a much more concise fashion. So I guess it's much more accessible. And it's got this kind of chronological approach, isn't it? So most of the chapters cover a particular decade. I think the first one and the last one are a slight exception. They cover slightly longer time spans. But mostly it's, you know, the 30s to the 40s to the 50s and so on. And then individual sections within that kind of address particular performers or other key aspects like genres. So, yeah, what did you think about the structure he kind of settled on here? Was this the kind of natural way to tell this story, to cover this subject?
I think this is such an overwhelmingly big subject matter to condense into a book. So I think it does its the best it can. I almost think that each chapter could be its own book. There's so yeah. much information. And I did like the fact that it is chronological, but within each of those chapters, there are like thematic essays. And as mm-hmm. you said, either focusing on a particular performer or sometimes a couple performers, comparing them or following their journeys in kind of parallel. Or so, and sometimes he'll talk about a particular performer a few times rather than just once and kind of abandoning that performer and moving on to others. I did feel that there's so much information in the later chapters, like the 80s and the 90s and now, that it almost read like a list of movies.
Yes.
The thing is, those chapters could have been even longer, but then it would have imbalanced the book. You would have had would have very long chapters at the end and very short chapters at the beginning. So I understand the need to kind of construct it so that it's all kind of even, but when you get to the blaxploitation movies in the 70s, everything kind of explodes and there's more performers, there's more movies, there's more information. So I almost think that these could have been, I don't know, this could have been two books or it could have been 10 books. There's so much information.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad you said that, actually, because I was going to say something and I was wondering if I was being harsh or if I was wondering if this kind of reflected my kind of interests. Mm-hmm. So, because I felt like the book was on a bit stronger ground with the earlier chapters, you know, and I was thinking, well, maybe that's just because I like classic film and the earlier eras and so on. But I think it is more than that. I think it is what you say. It does get a bit more list-like.
Yes.
I noticed more typos creep in the second half of the book, too.
Yes, I did notice that as well.
But yeah, I also felt like an element of repetition maybe crept in. So he kept referring to the theme of interracial male bonding and maybe not developing that as far as it could have been. So perhaps, though, it's a sign that the book has done its job well in some ways. I mean, it's trying to be very succinct, and it is. Mm-hmm. But occasionally there are details I'd have liked him to unpack a little bit further. And mostly that was in the second part of the book, I think.
The second part of the book could have been its own book. Yeah. Much longer, taken its time, had more room to linger, offer more context, more observations. But yeah, it did feel like maybe slightly rushed and a little too list-like, like you said.
Yeah, because like when he mentions Singleton's Boys in the Hood later on, he alludes to the fact that the treatment of women in the film may be problematic. And I thought, well, it'd be kind of nice here to understand why he's saying that. But I think perhaps in his other books, it's maybe fleshed out a bit more, that kind of thing. What comes through, though, really well, I think, is that the people he's written about, and this goes back to why it's a good structure, I think, overall. You know, the people he's written about are part of a larger struggle. It's not historical, sadly. It's an ongoing struggle, yes. You know. So they're kind of like links in a chain. So if they are links in a chain, I think it's really valid to present this chain in a, you know, a chronological fashion from A to Z almost.
Yeah, I agree. And also what I thought was interesting about the book is how he demonstrates how individual performers, once they come onto the scene and contribute mm-hmm. something meaningful to Hollywood, kind of opens doors for other yeah. performers and other, especially like somebody like Lena Horne or Sidney Poitier, especially Sidney Poitier. There's a lot of information about how his films in the 50s and 60s really opened doors for other films to come in the decades that followed. So yeah, I think, like you said, linking how all of these performers kind of linked over time is super interesting. And yeah, you especially see that in the earlier chapters where there's so many roadblocks. There's so many, like, we still have like all this prejudice and this racial tension. But one thing that the author does really well is connecting the subject matter to, and showing us the connection to like the political and social issues of yep. the time, and how these films and these performers came out of that, and also how they affected it too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that really came through to me in this book and in the earlier book of his that I read, is I think he really conveys well how the stereotypes of each era kind of differ from the ones of the era before.
Yes.
Because I think it can be tough sometimes for contemporary audiences to understand how filmgoers in the past were able to accept things that look very dated today. You know, so for instance, we read here, don't we, about somebody like Stepin Fetchit, who majored in playing like confused, inarticulate characters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think somebody being introduced to those films today would quite possibly find them very cringeworthy, you know.
Right.
But what Bogle puts across well, you know, you get the sense that, well, this guy was the first star of his kind. He had great comic timing. He got screen time for himself that was valuable. He was able to use it to draw attention to himself. So I think what comes across quite well is like the gradual nature of change. And I think that's one thing the book does nicely. But I guess who's the ideal reader for this, you know? Because I was wondering if maybe a possible problem, I don't even know if that's the right word, but with these first two books that we're going to talk about here, is it would be a shame if they end up being read mostly by people who largely already share the worldview that's put forward.
I think the power of a book like this would be that it could please somebody who is really into film history, because yeah. I recently have been, you know, researching and writing about Black performers in classic film history. For example, I used this book to write a piece on Lena Horne. Mm-hmm. So for me, as somebody who has some background in classic film knowledge, I still had a lot to learn from this book. So that was very useful. But I think also in somebody who maybe didn't know very much about Black film history would learn a ton. So I feel yeah. like it has something to offer a newbie and something to offer somebody who knows a lot about the subject, but still could learn more. Maybe it's not for somebody who knows everything about the subject, but it does have that appeal. I think it could appeal to two different types of readers.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, well, I'm not really sure who the ideal reader is, but I think, kind of like you say, I think classic film fans who are not that familiar with, whoever it may be, a filmmaker like Oscar Michaud, who's covered, or somebody like Teresa Harris, or whomever it is, you know, people who are not familiar with those figures will get a lot from it. I think people who are fans of some of these people from any era, but who haven't really stopped to think about the broader context within which they operated, you know, will finish reading the book with an enlarged perspective. So let's say somebody was a big fan of Denzel Washington, but, you know, hadn't thought about some of these other issues. I think they would get a lot from this. So yeah, I think fans of modern day filmmaking will have some of their preconceptions about old Hollywood challenged too. And that's always a good thing, in my opinion.
And one thing too, I thought of with this book is, is anybody who's studying film in college or university, this is a great introduction if you're really interested in exploring how race is represented in film. And if you're particularly interested in African-American film history, this is just like the perfect introduction and a springboard to really do a deep dive on particular themes, particular eras, particular people from this history.
Yeah, kind of a great gateway book.
Yes.
If you're kind of put off by the size of his other work, for instance, or whatever it might be. Or maybe the absence of photos, because that's another area where this book differs from Bogle's earlier works, is because this has very extensive use of photographs, doesn't it?
Yeah, I felt that the presentation of this was quite beautiful.
Yeah, because some of these shots as well, it's interesting that they've rarely been published, you know. So in a lot of cases, I think most readers won't have seen these photos before.
Mm-hmm.
And in his introduction, Bogle writes, "These seldom seen photographs serve to bring a movie and an era to startling life." I think he's correct there.
And what I like about it is that there's plenty of text. So this isn't just your standard coffee table book with lots of pictures and maybe a little bit of text. I mean, this is the photos, a lot of portraits, behind the scenes shots, publicity stills, posters. They're presented in various ways, but it's not meant to be a glossy coffee table book. So it's a nice, I like that sort of thing. I like a combination of information and something beautiful to look at. So I feel like that pleases both sides of me. Like I want to look at these photos, but I also want to learn a lot about what these photos are connected to.
And I think this goes back again, perhaps in some ways, to the point we made earlier about the book being stronger in the first half, let's say, because mm-hmm. I felt with the images that, especially with some of the older performers, so somebody like Eddie Rochester Anderson or Bill Robinson or whoever, I think the images that are presented, it really does help to kind of supplement the introduction to these figures that the text provides. So it's not that the newer performers don't benefit from that too, but I think most readers are going to come to the book with a clearer view of who somebody like, I don't know, Eddie Murphy is, than they will have of the performers of like the 1920s and 30s.
That's a great observation. No, I totally agree with you because, yeah, if somebody comes to this book with knowledge of maybe the last 20 years of this film history, but maybe they don't know the earlier players. Yeah, the photos give a lot of context and it's a great introduction to these people.
Okay, so it sounds like it's a big thumbs up, you know, with some minor reservations for Hollywood Black from both of us. Anything else you wanted to say about this book before we move on to Dynamic Dames, Raquel?
I have to say, this is just a beautiful presentation too. The cover is gorgeous. I think it's really well designed. I thought just how it's the fonts that they use, the way that they present the photos, how it holds in your hands. Like, these are all little details I like to explore with books. I mean, the binding's really nice. It's just if you're going to invest in a book about film history, this is a very nice present to give to somebody. This is a really nice addition to your home library. So I think it's really well packaged.
And I think these are all things that you notice because of your kind of specialized knowledge of, you know, publishing and so on, isn't it? So I think we talked about binding once before on the podcast.
Yes, I love to talk about end papers and the spine and the dust jackets. So these are all things I like to geek out about. And I think also when I mention this in my reviews, is just to show you what the quality is of the book that you're buying. Because, yeah, I mean, we are investing our money into this. What are we getting in return? So, I do like to geek out about that stuff.
No, it makes perfect sense that I never really think about things like the font, but of course that's an important factor. Well, like, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to read a book that's 200, 300, 400 pages and the font is terrible on your eyes, it's going to make it a miserable experience.
Okay, so let's move on to the second book that we're talking about today, which is Dynamic Dames, 50 Leading Ladies Who Made History, written by Sloane DeForest, who, you know, regular listeners will have heard me speak to a few episodes ago about this book in more detail. She was a pleasure to talk to, and I think some of my views kind of crept into that episode, even though I tried to mostly stick to kind of the interviewer role. But yeah, I mean, you've interviewed her on a couple of occasions too, haven't you, Raquel?
Yes, I I very much enjoyed hearing that episode and hear you guys Thank talk you. About the book. And I learned quite a lot from her in terms of how she chose the women who were on the cover and how they were presented. So there's a lot of really interesting things there. And yeah, I interviewed her for TCM for this book and for her must-see sci-fi book for my blog. And she's always such a pleasure. She's very insightful. She has a lot to say. And she's also very passionate about classic movies. And that comes through.
Yeah. So just to reiterate, in short, this is a book that highlights some of the most memorable, empowering female characters from film history, as well as the women who played them. It's not just from the classic era, but it's from more recent times too. So just to name a few, almost at random, you know, the book discusses people like, you know, Barbara Stanwyck, Natalie Wood, Julia Roberts, Joan Crawford, Jane Fonda, Emma Watson, and many more. So yeah, Raquel, I'd just like to give you the opportunity here, because I've seen your review of this book, I think, and this was one that really kind of hit home for you. You enjoyed this one a lot, is that right?
Yes, this is the book I didn't realize I always wanted. I love the message of female empowerment. This is feminist film history that doesn't beat the subject matter over your head. Like, this is very just enjoyable to read. Mm-hmm. It's very enlightening. And I like that not everything is what you'd expect. Like, it's Audrey Hepburn's in this book, but it's not Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's. It's Sister Luke from The Nun's Story. So I like that it's a mix of some iconic characters and some maybe lesser known ones, with a focus on how that female character is portrayed on screen, what's powerful about her, how the actress influenced that role, and what the circumstances were to make that character happen, which I think that kind of background is super interesting. And I like that it's presented thematically and within the themes chronologically in a way. So something I said in my review is that I feel like a classic film person might abandon it if it was completely chronological. They might stop at the 1960s. But the last section is more newer actresses and characters, and the first section is older ones, but still it's a mix in between. So I feel like if somebody likes classic movies but is more hesitant about new movies, there's a lot to learn here. And in the reverse, if somebody comes into this book saying, you know, oh, well, old movies were all sexist, there's no interesting female characters, this is a learning experience. This is definitely will open your eyes to these amazing roles from the past that you might not have thought existed. So I think that the strength of the book is that it can work both ways. And for me, I have never been convinced to watch The Terminator until I read this book. Yeah. And I read the section about Terminator and Terminator 2. I stopped the book and watched the movie and then went back to the book to finish it. So that to me speaks to the strength of her narrative style. It's very engaging and very convincing.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, I really like it as well. And I think in terms of the book's structure, and I kind of asked her about this when I spoke to her, and, you know, she talked about how it provides a loose journey where, like you say, it starts with, it's pre-code bad girls, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The first category. And then superheroines is the final one. So it's kind of like, a journey is the right word for it. That's what it is. It's a journey with a very definite start and end point. And then there are some interesting and surprising stops along the way that aren't always where you'd expect, you know. So it does kind of jump around a little bit. And I think it works well. Because I think what I said on a podcast before, I like some of the juxtapositions it throws up. So you go from Grace Kelly to Jodie Foster. You go from Marlene Dietrich to Pam Grier.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't have got that necessarily in a straight chronological account. And I don't know, I just think it injects a sense of liveliness and spontaneity in a funny sort of way. Kind of keeps you on your toes as a reader. But so it's kind of doing something different to Hollywood Black, isn't it? And while I praised the chronological approach for Hollywood Black, I think the tack Sloane DeForest takes here works really well too. I guess because the focus is a little bit narrower than what Hollywood Black was trying to do. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it doesn't address things like the industry and changes in the industry and stereotyping and so on, because that definitely all comes up. But it's a bit narrow in the sense that she doesn't showcase like female directors unless it's with somebody like Jodie Foster, who happens to also have directed films as well as being an actress, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is I felt that the not strictly chronological approach worked because in each case, I felt it was more about whether I was engaged with the stories about these women as individuals.
Yeah. And now you have me thinking maybe she should write one about female directors, because I would totally pick that up and read that. Yeah. That would be amazing. But also I felt too that the author has a very engaging kind of almost like charming narrative voice that mm-hmm. this is like, it's like you're sitting down with somebody who's telling you all these really great stories about film history. It is enticing you to try something maybe you hadn't tried before and maybe look into it. And it, like I said, with the Hollywood Black Book, like it's a springboard for more exploration and maybe more discussion and more research on things. So in a good way, this is a good introduction.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think she acknowledges in the intro that she writes, you know, this is not trying to be definitive. You know, there's that section at the back of the book, isn't there, about more dynamic dames. And that almost could become a book in itself one day, you know. But something like this is necessarily partial. And I think the reader's got to accept that, like, I didn't put down the book thinking about any of the women who weren't included. I think that's kind of the wrong approach to take. But I think with what Bogle was doing in Hollywood Black, like, if he'd have left out somebody like Denzel Washington or Eddie Murphy, with what he was trying to do, that would have been a big problem.
Yeah.
You know, but this is kind of a different attack that she's taken. So both totally valid approaches, just slightly different. Like you said, yeah, I think it was a nice mix of, like, no-brainer choices along with more left-field picks for some of these performers. Also, she manages to name drop a lot of other films along the way, doesn't she? In addition to the one she kind of covers with a bit more length, I suppose.
I appreciated that a lot. I appreciated that even though each section focuses on one character and one actress, you get to learn a little bit about that actress's other parts, maybe and how they connect to this one and other key players as well. So yeah, you get a lot of context. And I like, I mean, in the conversation you guys had on the podcast was mm-hmm. about how she was kind of given freedom to pick what she wanted. And that really makes this intriguing because you're getting the author's perspective. And if there was a lot of pressure to pick certain parts and certain actresses, you would have gotten a much more predictable book that wouldn't have been as engaging. So I feel like this has an author's touch, which I feel like is hard to do in nonfiction and publishing because there's so much pressure from other people, your editor, your agent, whatever, or even like conceived notions of what the reader wants. But I like that this is presented and, you know, the reader comes in and it's like kind of a nice surprise in a way.
Yeah, I think so too. But again, I wonder if the question is like, does this book end up in the hands of people who might have their eyes opened by it?
Yes.
Because I've attended one or two events over here mm-hmm. In this country about women in film, and I've heard women speak there about how it can be really dispiriting that they're normally kind of preaching to the converted, you know, that what you end up with at those kind of events, with some exceptions, are you get rooms full of women who kind of already agree with each other, and they're not reaching the people who possibly need to be reached. But I think this is a book that would have broad appeal, you know, and I think it will satisfy like the vast majority of people who do read it.
Yeah, as you said, it could be a situation where the people who pick up this book is just preaching to the choir, you know, just kind of the echo chamber effect, just talking to people who already agree with these opinions. I'm worried that the pink cover might be off-putting a little bit. I do like the cover, and I like how the women are presented. I like the structure of the book. I do wish it might have been slightly bigger, or it could have been kind of like her sci-fi book paperback instead. I already damaged my copy. The paper, this is me geeking out about the format again.
Yeah.
This is paper overboard.
Okay.
So it does make it a little vulnerable to damage because there is no dust jacket to protect it. It is quite beautiful. It is compact, so it's nice to hold. But in terms of how it's presented, I worry that the pink cover and dynamic dames on the top might be like, oh, this is for women and only for women, where I hope that men are okay with over, you know, getting over that hurdle. If that is a hurdle that you have. And I do hope too that recently the author was on Turner Classic Movies to present some of the characters and films in the book on the channel.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that just opened up possibilities for new readers who might not have been interested in it just seeing the title or the cover.
Yeah, I really like the cover. So, guys, if you're listening, if you don't like Pink, get over it. You know, it's good. But it's interesting what she said to me about the cover and how she kind of asked for it to be changed and so on. Because it sounded like she was presented with some pictures of these women in boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't like the associations with them being kind of boxed in, confined.
That was fascinating.
Yeah, because the Hollywood Black cover does have the kind of box structure, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I guess I do prefer the Dynamic Dames one. I think it's really striking.
And one thing, too, is I liked what she had said about Dorothy Dandridge being on the front with her hands on her hips, and she has kind of a very powerful pose. And I think that makes... I mean, there's four actresses behind her, but really your eye is drawn to Dorothy Dandridge, and I think that's just the perfect... kind of like perfect shot to have on the cover. So I thought that was super interesting.
Yeah. So I guess what I'd say, so if you're weighing up whether to check this book out or not, I'd say that anyone, male or female, if you haven't seen a reasonable number of the films in this book, so I don't know if you can check somehow, but I think you'll benefit from reading it and enjoy it. I'm not saying that someone who has seen all the films won't like the book. I'm sure they will. And I'm sure that a lot of the details will be fresh for them. I guess if you're someone who's wary about things like gender politics being discussed, I know some people are.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a book that's persuasive, it's well argued, but it's not preachy. And that's what Sloane DeForest said to me, I think. She didn't want to put too fine a point on some of the issues that come up, and I don't think she does. I don't think that's what happens. I don't know. I mean, it's possibly quite natural that of the people who rushed out to buy it, most of them will be women, perhaps. But I don't know if that's the case, but... that's what you'd suspect. But I'd also say it's maybe a good book to give as a gift to the men in your life, maybe. That might be a way to kind of get this book in front of someone who will get a lot out of it. I don't know.
I agree. I think this is very giftable. If you... I hadn't thought of giving it to a man and kind of introducing that, but I think that's perfect. I thought it would be great for people who like new movies and are skeptical about sexism in old movies, that this is kind of a great gift to give to them to kind of open up their mind and broaden their horizons a bit. So basically for the classic film skeptics, I think this is good. And yes. I think, to be honest, this book is just so well written. The author, I noticed this about her sci-fi book as well. Her writing is amazing. She's got a way with words. This is so engaging. If anything, read this for some good writing. It's just so pleasurable to read what she has to say and the way she says it. So I think that itself is the strength of the book. If somebody just wants kind of, I mean, it's an easy read, but there's so much information too that it's just, I don't know, it's very palatable. It's very nice.
Yeah, I found all of these really palatable, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, across the board, which is good, which I didn't necessarily know if that would be the case. But yeah, really good. Okay, so let's move on to the final book we're going to chat about today, which is... Forbidden Hollywood, When Sin Ruled the Movies by Mark A. Vieira. And this is a book which covers the so-called pre-code era. So the pre-code era being 1930 to 1934. So this is the period when the production code existed but wasn't enforced. It also covers the kind of real pre-code era is what he calls it, just before that. But that's the kind of the focal point of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the book spotlights some of the films that caused the most controversy and ultimately led to the code being properly implemented later on. So yeah, the films under discussion include such titles as Hell's Angels, Little Caesar, Dracula, Babyface. As far as I can recall, I think I'm right in saying this was a book that was discussed on the classic film book Gift Ideas podcast that you and I and Vanessa did last December. So I guess the question is, was it worth the wait? Because I think you were looking forward to it, weren't you?
Yes, I think both Vanessa and I had this as our like top pick of what we were excited about. And this delivers. This was just so wonderful. I think in my review, I called it the ideal film book, like a marriage between kind of entertainment and information, because it's just presented so beautifully. And Mark Vieira is a photographer himself. He has access to all these amazing, gorgeous photographs. And he's just so knowledgeable as a film historian as well. So there's all this really amazing information too. It's just, it's quite amazing. It really did live up to my expectations, which was good.
Yeah, I had a blast with this one, actually. I read it all in one day.
Wow.
Almost in one sitting. I sat out in the garden and read it, and I think that's quite rare for me. I'm often a fairly slow reader, to be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I kind of blazed through this one, which was nice. A lot of it was new information to me, so there's a real sense of discovery. Mm-hmm. You know, because I was aware of the basics about the pre-code era, and I'd seen a lot of the films. But I think what the book does really well is drill into it mm-hmm. in a way that's informative and is very authoritative. It doesn't get bogged down in detail, in my view.
I would agree to a certain extent. I have to say that the whole history of the pre-code era is so complicated when it comes to the yeah. actual production code. And I think the author does a great job giving us as much information as possible and also presenting themes and connecting different different events and kind of showcasing how things progressed over those years. But when it comes to the actual production code, it is a lot of information. Yeah. So yeah. it can be very overwhelming. But I think I learned so much, and I felt like I already knew quite a lot about the pre-code era, but I just learned an immense amount that, I found this incredibly valuable, even though some of the particulars of the production code still are a little, they're kind of head scratchers in a way, but it is a very, very complicated history.
Yeah, I think that's kind of unavoidable, isn't it, that he would have had to find a way around that. And I think by and large he does, you know. And
yes.
What he says is his goal is to kind of take you or take the reader back to that era, to bring it to life. So I guess the question is, has he achieved that? And I think one of the most important ways he finds to do that is by the manner in which he utilizes all these source materials, doesn't he? From
yes.
all sorts of people. So I thought it was really great to hear what like ordinary filmgoers said about some of these movies, you know, in letters they wrote over time. It was also really fascinating to read about things like theatre owners, you know, who were kind of nervous about having their reputations damaged when they showed kind of salacious films and stuff like that. And then some of the correspondence, like from the executives to the censors. So, because he says, Vieira says, film history should never be written without a human context.
That's great.
And I think that's a very interesting point, yeah, because I think often classic films are analysed without the audience being considered. Or if we do talk about the audience, we talk about how well, you know, how many people turned up at the box office for a particular film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this book's not like that, is it? It really does make good use of those sources.
No, I agree. And I wrote down that line as well, because it's just that
yeah.
that is so true. And I think really important, and when you're exploring film history, is to know that context, that human context. And I mean, some of the things interesting about that source material that he was providing. Yeah, it basically opens up a whole new world. You're really understanding all the different factors that go into how this era came to be, what was going on, and eventually how the production code was enforced. One thing I thought was super interesting is how it's something that I didn't know very much about was the self-regulation that the states had, like how they would have these films edited to be presented to fit their own regulations. So you had various versions of these yeah. movies floating yeah. out around there. And I thought that was very eye-opening and interesting, something I hadn't thought of. I live in Massachusetts here in the United States, and Banned in Boston was very is something they were known for. Like, we had a very conservative past, and it was just interesting learning about my home state and how my state edited and self-regulated some of these films and how it had an impact on how the production code came to be. So very, very enlightening.
Yeah, I just wanted to turn to a particular page, kind of chosen at random. So this is about Public Enemy, I think. Page 60 in the book, just to give people a flavour of the kind of stuff he's drawing in. So he quotes from a letter that Will Hayes received. He was disgusted. You know, such pictures as Little Caesar are more destructive to the morality of our country than any other single force today. The public expects you to censor these movies. He also quotes, somebody wrote a letter to Motion Picture Magazine. These pictures are more apt to teach right from wrong. Somebody else, another letter, and he has a comment from Al Capone, which I just thought was funny. These gang pictures, that's terrible kid stuff. They're doing nothing but harm to the younger element of the country. I don't blame the censors for trying to bar them.
Wow.
Just all the way through, he's drawing in lots of interesting stuff, and you get a really broad range of perspectives, I think. And it's always fun. I don't know, this might be another area you can kind of geek out about, I don't know, but always fun to read at the back of these books about the research that's kind of been put in.
Oh, yes.
And it certainly sounds comprehensive in this case, you know?
Yeah, I do look at the back matter. So it's really interesting to see his sources, what and also in it, just to learn a little bit about his method. I interviewed him for this book as well, and it was interesting how, I mean, he had already written a book about the pre-code era. It's called Sins and Soft Focus, mm-hmm. but that's been out of print for some time. So he revisits it, and he was talking about all the sources he used for his photographs that he includes in this book, but also the sources to get all that. Interesting material, the correspondence and the reactions and all of that, how he gathers it up
yeah.
for this. It's just kind of an amazing feat in a way. And one thing too, I noticed, is just to mention before I forget, is that he really points out the themes in terms of the cycles that happen in the pre-code era. Mm. I thought that was super interesting how these worked in cycles. There was the gangster film cycle, the horror cycle, fallen women, kept women, the jungle cycle. It was interesting how he explores how themes would pop up, and also how he shows from 1930 to 1934 how these films got away with so much, and how that progressed, how these films became more and more salacious as they tested the waters, got away with things, then used those films as precedent to work on other things and be even more salacious, or how they even would throw in a lot of red herrings, some quotes like from She Done Him Wrong. Some quotes were added that they knew would be taken away, but that would distract you from the quotes, maybe the lines of dialogue that they wanted to keep in the first place. Just fascinating stuff that I really hadn't thought of, that really is just placed in context and makes you learn a lot about the pre-code era. And also, if you weren't interested in pre-code movies, you cannot not be interested after this.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I guess people might be wondering whether the book covers specific films well or not. So I guess the thing to stress is he's focusing on like the controversial aspects of these films. Mm-hmm. So you probably need to look elsewhere for like a really in-depth examination of these titles he's covering. But you definitely get enough, I think. You definitely get sufficient information for like the specific reasons the era is writing about that film. Do you think so?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the films he chooses, they're there for a reason. You kind of learn what the subtext is of what makes it a pre-code movie and how it fits, and also how it influenced other movies to be made, how it affected the performers and the directors, and how it scared the committees and how it led to censorship later on. I think they're well chosen, but yeah, if you really want to do a deep dive on maybe the Sign of the Cross, you should probably learn a little bit from here and then go watch the movie and then do some extra research.
And I think it's also worth stressing that we get some other sections in the book that look at different aspects. So there are sections entitled like the MGM Gloss or the Paramount Glow, for mm-hmm. example, give you a sense of the character of particular studios at this point in time. And again, it's another book with lots of incredible photos.
Yes.
A lot of great portraits of stars by people like George Harrell. There are some that just made me stop reading so I could sit and kind of gaze at them for a little while, you know. So, I don't know. There's a portrait of Barbara Stanwyck by Elma Fryer on page 79 that I was just entranced by. But yeah, what did you think, Raquel? What did you make of like the look of the book and all these great portraits?
Well, I brought this book to work with me, which I do all the time. I have a book bag and I bring my latest film book with me and a little notebook and pen, and I bring it so I can read at work on my lunch break. And I brought this and I had turned to a particular image of somebody who hadn't been wearing much clothing, and I had to close the book just to look to see if there's anyone behind me seeing it. So there are some very sexy photos in this book that maybe are not safe for work purposes, but gorgeous to look at and to linger over. Yeah, I mean, this book is just, if anything, I mean, Mark Vierre is known for his amazing coffee table books. I have his book about film noir and his book about Cecil B. DeMille. Both are quite gorgeous. The film noir book is not even as good as this book about pre-code. I think this is excellent. But yeah, it's just, the photos are just something you want to take your time with, for sure. Or if you like, you read the book, just go back, read it a second time just to linger over the photographs.
Yeah, so there's like some great shots of people like Joan Crawford too. So it was really fascinating, I think, to read about there's kind of this disquiet when she changed her appearance for the film Rain, and she's wearing all this lipstick and stuff like that. I guess, finally, well, I was wondering, I could imagine someone being like a pretty big classic film fan, but just being, for one reason or another, someone who may have only seen a few of these films in question, just depending on exactly where their interest lay. You know, maybe they like different stars, maybe they like the 40s rather than the 30s and so on. So I guess this book differs from the first two in that it's got this narrower focus. So would you call it, like, would you say it's a bit more of a specialized title than those first two?
I would totally call it that. I think that if you're not interested in the pre-code era and if you're not interested in film history, this book is not for you. This is not, it's very comprehensive and you'll learn a lot, but if you're not interested in the subject matter, it's not something to pick up. I think it might be too overwhelming with information. This is really for people who are interested in the 1930s, who are interested in pre-code films and want to know maybe more about censorship or more about what set Hollywood to make the films that came in the late 30s and the 40s, if it's just kind of get that early history. But yeah, if you're not into film history, this is not, this would be too specialized, I think. Maybe not as approachable as Hollywood Black or Dynamic Dames.
Yeah, so I guess final thoughts, Raquel. I mean, this is a really strong lineup of books from TCM Running Press, isn't it? And these titles have a lot to offer generally, don't they?
I agree. I think every single one of these is worth the investment in your money and your time. I mean, they're beautiful objects to hold. There's lots of really great information. They're well written. They're well presented. And you'll come away with something meaningful from each one. So I think if you're going to get, if you're interested in classic film books or you were thinking about these and weren't sure, I would recommend all three.
Yeah. So listeners, if any of you do pick any of these books up, let us know what you make of it. Let us know your thoughts, you know, on social media and so on. I'd be delighted to hear from you. I just wanted to say give a quick shout out and say a quick thank you to Victoria Gilder, who sent me these books out for review. So thanks, Victoria. Okay, Raquel, pleasure as ever to talk to you today. I hope it's not too long until we podcast together again. I hope so anyway. So just what are you up to these days online? Where can people find you? All the usual stuff.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Carl, and always thank a pleasure you. To talk about film books. I love that this is our thing now. Yeah. So you guys can find me on outofthepastblog.com. That's my classic film blog. I also have a YouTube channel where I did reviews of both Forbidden Hollywood and Dynamic Dames, and I'm working on a Hollywood Black one as well. I have video reviews on there. It's just YouTube, and just look up Out of the Past Blog. I have an Instagram all about movies called Kel Movies, and then you can find me on Twitter, just my name, at Raquel Stitcher, and I love to talk about movies with people, so come find me, please.
And just in terms of the reading challenge, it's too late for people to enter this year, right? So if people are intrigued, they might have to wait till 2020 now. Is that correct?
Yes. So I'll probably announce the next one in May or June of next year. And I've been running them since 2013 and I have no intention to stop. So I hope people will join me next year.
I mean, next year is going to come around before we know it, isn't
yes.
it? Yes. I'm astonished how quickly the time is flying these days. Okay, listeners, that's it for today. We're in all the usual places online. So come and find us, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for Movie Palace. You should find us easily enough. At Movie Palace Pod on Twitter. I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace. If you enjoyed this episode of the Movie Palace and you'd like to support the podcast financially, you can buy me a cup of coffee via the Ko-fi website. Go to ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. That's ko-fi.com/Carl Sweeney. CarlSweeney. Thank you.